This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chitakis. This is what it sounds like to build a sidewalk. You're in LA's Pico Robertson neighborhood, and this kind of work is happening every day all across the city of Los Angeles. And there's a good reason why. There are more than 9,000 miles of walkways in LA. David Ramirez lives with his wife and two kids in this neighborhood.
It's long overdue. You know, the sidewalks here are so staggered and uneven. I know my fellow neighbor's been complaining. I mean, you can look right there. Look at that. That's just insane.
Now, some of the sidewalks around here have black asphalt patches covering broken places. There are large cracks. Things are getting fixed here today, but the city's got thousands of repair requests to get to. So many that city officials can't really give an exact number. And with that many broken sidewalks, that much broken concrete, the city simply cannot keep up.
We're getting approximately 60 to 70 requests per month.
And how many can you guys handle per month?
Approximately 10 that we were able to physically repair per month.
That's Julie Sauter, deputy city engineer. She's basically in charge of the city's sidewalk repair program. And yeah, she says they do about 10 a month. That's only a tiny fraction of the number of sidewalks that actually break. So then, why do you ask, does it take so long to fix a sidewalk in L.A.? KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb went out to answer that question, and he's with me right now in the studio. Hello, Benjamin.
Hello, Steve.
Welcome back. I'm glad you're not, like, in traction after all the broken sidewalks. Let's start with how we got here and why are so many of L.A. sidewalks broken.
So it's a great place to start, Steve, and a big part of the equation is trees. The way they've been planted, what kind of trees they are. And when I spoke with the city of Los Angeles, they were very careful not to put all of the blame on the trees. As you can imagine, there's a lot of activism in Los Angeles surrounding the protection of trees, especially older trees. But listen to how Julie Sauter describes the problem.
You know, many of these trees were planted, you know, 40 years ago, and that's what makes it challenging because, you know, these are, you know, mature growths. They are very precious to our community. But on the other side, you know, some of these trees are much, you know, because of the 40-year growth, they've obviously have outgrown the space that was initially, you know, established.
So I went out to kind of find an example of this where trees were just kind of exploding out of the ground. In Boyle Heights is a stretch of Soto Street that's just south of 4th. It looks more like a miniature golf course than a sidewalk. There are a bunch of ficus trees there. They have those enormous root networks that rise out of the ground. Entire planks, Steve, of concrete are uplifted. They're jagged. Anyway, when I was there, I hung out with Carmina Gomez and John Yee of Los Angeles Walks. This is a pedestrian advocacy group. Take a listen.
Most people just resign themselves to this really awful LA zeitgeist, which is this is just the way our city is, and we just got to live with it.
The common denominator here on this street, it appears, is that the trees are really doing damage to the sidewalk. It's a huge issue. They're pushing, displacing all this concrete. Is that just how trees are, or is there an urban planning problem with these trees?
I mean, trees naturally are supposed to expand and grow. So with that knowledge, planners should keep in mind that you should probably plant your trees deeper so that you don't have uprooting and interruption in the sidewalk.
So it's all the trees' fault? I mean, don't we need trees?
Yeah, I mean, it's not all the trees' fault, to be clear. There is a big planning problem here, too. Let's go back in time to the 1970s. The city made a promise to fix sidewalks damaged by tree roots. And by doing so, the city took responsibility away from property owners. Previously, the property owners, had been expected to handle any such repairs. And that seemed reasonable at the time because homeowners, property owners, for the most part, they didn't plant the trees that were causing these problems to the sidewalks. But the city could not keep its promise. It ran out of money. And for decades, the city's sidewalks here in Los Angeles suffered. Now, you may be thinking, okay, if I had to choose between broken sidewalks and a shady pathway in LA, where it gets very, very hot, we also know the benefits of having a green city, the choice may be pretty easy, right? But that is, of course, if you can walk on those sidewalks. The situation is very different for someone who lives with a disability. I caught up with a woman named Cindy Soto. She lives in Long Beach, but she commutes to work in downtown LA. She can't walk.
I was born with a disability, and then about 14 years ago, I sustained a spinal cord injury, which prevents a movement for me below my shoulders. So that means that I need to drive my motorized wheelchair with my chin.
So she uses her chin to drive her wheelchair. She's on the sidewalks every day in that chair. Listen to how she describes the last leg of her commute, the half mile to and from the metro station on 7th and Figueroa.
I think, you know, I could go off into a ditch. It's like, or fall off the cliff. And that's how it feels to me to use the sidewalk. If you can imagine yourself doing that, then you'll know how I feel.
Yeah. I mean, you say, Benjamin, that the city ran out of money. We pay taxes, right? There has to be money for this, though, for sidewalk repair, right?
There sure is. And just a little background on that. There was a class action lawsuit by a group of disabled people, disabled residents in Los Angeles. It was settled about 4 years ago. Cindy Soto was actually a plaintiff in this case. And the case centered on improving sidewalks for people living with disabilities. The city agreed, as part of the settlement, to invest nearly $1.5 billion over the next 3 decades in repairing sidewalks. They're supposed to gradually spend more and more as the years go on. And right now, the city is spending roughly $41 million on sidewalks a year.
All right, so where's all that money going?
So the city is only responsible for fixing sidewalks that are too broken for a disabled person to use and that someone has complained about. But as I'm sure you've seen, there are sidewalks all across Los Angeles that need repairs. And those are actually the responsibility of home and business owners to fix.
Wait, what? They're the responsibility of home and business owners.
That's right. So if there's a sidewalk that's outside of your property, your house, your business, you're actually now responsible to fix it.
All right. So what if you can't afford to fix your sidewalk?
Exactly. Well, the city took that into consideration. They had this idea, a rebate program launched a couple years ago, and it worked like this. You could file a request to fix your sidewalk and then get a rebate from the city afterward, which sounds like a good idea, right?
Okay, yeah.
Except that program, because of how bad the sidewalks were, it filled up so quickly with requests that it ran out of money. So now there's an enormous backlog, and because of that, it's since been suspended.
The program's been suspended. All right, so we know how the repairs are prioritized in the city. Why isn't that enough money, though, to keep up with all the repair requests?
It's a fair question, and it's one that I posed to Julie Sauter. Take a listen to how she describes why this is so difficult.
We didn't even know where all our sidewalks were. So some of the requirements of the settlement agreement is that we have to map all of the requests. We have to map all of the repairs completed. And how do you do that mapping when you don't even know where your sidewalks are?
It seems like it's a little bit of a frustration for you about how long it takes, unless I'm reading you incorrectly.
No, it's just that there's just a tremendous need, but we have a limited amount of resources to address these on a year-by-year basis.
What does it take? Is it more people in this building? Is it more money? What do you guys need to make this go faster?
You know, I think as a city, a larger city, we need to look at maybe different opportunities outside of, you know, just what is allocated for the sidewalk repair program, you know, partnering with, you know, other entities.
Those other entities that she's referring to is actually a partnerships with the private sector, also exploring other types of material other than traditional concrete to pour onto our sidewalks to make them maybe more resistant to some of the damage that they experience from trees or from earthquakes, stuff like that. But I want to get back to the math really quickly. If you do the math and you look at what they're spending and what's getting fixed, the city is spending $41 million a year on fixing sidewalks, but they can only get to about 10 to 15 requests per month.
Yeah.
So it's costing them hundreds of thousands of dollars per sidewalk request.
Mm.
And this is really important because the settlement does not say how the money should be spent. It only says that X amount of dollars need to go to sidewalks over the next 3 decades. So as you can see, Steve, there's definitely an efficiency problem with this.
And obviously a sidewalks in disrepair problem in Los Angeles, all over the place.
Absolutely.
KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb, thanks for your reporting.
You're very welcome.
Well, coming up, U.S. Border Patrol agents separated her from her young son. They're reunited now, but an asylum seeker is seeking legal justice. Her story next on KCRW's Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Parents who were separated from their children at the U.S.-Mexico border last year are launching a legal fight now against the Trump administration. About a dozen immigrant mothers and fathers are claiming that the federal government intended to inflict emotional distress by separating them from their kids. They did it on purpose. That's what they claim. One of those mothers is a woman named Patricia. U.S. border agents took her son when they crossed the Rio Grande into Texas last year to seek asylum. She didn't see her son for weeks. Maggie Krell is an attorney representing Patricia, and she joins me now to talk about this case and others like it. Hi, Maggie.
Hi.
We should mention that Patricia is going by her middle name because she fears retaliation. How did you meet her, and tell us a little bit about her story?
Sure. She fled from Honduras, a violent plagued area of Honduras where she was facing extreme threats and violence. And with her young 6-year-old son, she made the journey to seek safety and refuge in the United States. But when she got here, when she crossed into Texas, she was taken into custody like most migrants are, but she was also separated from her young son, and he was taken to another facility, and she wasn't given any information about his whereabouts.
How long was she separated from him?
They were separated for almost 40 days. And during that time, she was being held at Port Isabel Detention Center, and that's where I first met her when she was essentially in a jail cell. And she was just beside herself. She was suffering emotionally and physically from the trauma of not knowing where her son was. It's essentially every mom's worst nightmare, and it was a policy that the Trump administration instituted on so many families.
As part of that policy, the Trump administration has claimed that this is a deterrent, that they want people to know that when they come into the United States, there's a real possibility that they will be separated from their children. Did Patricia know that?
No, she did not know that, and you know, whether or not that would have been an effective deterrent isn't really the point here. The point is that the Trump administration did untold damage to this family and many others, and they inflicted extreme distress and trauma on children and their caregivers, and they said as much. And that is the definition of intentional infliction of emotional distress.
I want to fast forward about a year. Patricia and her son are reunited. You mentioned that it's been hard on them both. What kind of impact do you think did the separation have on them, particularly on her son?
This has extreme trauma. I mean, you know, children are resilient, and I'm hopeful that this family will ultimately be okay. But, you know, children have cried inconsolably. Parents wake up in the middle of the night with anxiety. Although her and her son have been reunited, they are still agonized by what happened. The trauma is long-lasting, and it outlives the separation, unfortunately.
They are currently in the United States. Are they still, they're seeking asylum in this country, correct?
Correct.
And at the same time, they are making this claim against the Trump administration, perhaps a lawsuit against the administration in the future. What is the legal argument?
The legal argument falls under the Federal Tort Claims Act, which essentially is an opportunity to hold the government accountable for claims of misconduct or negligence. In this case, the underlying claim is intentional infliction of emotional distress and potentially other claims to hold the government accountable, to hold the Trump administration accountable for this unprecedented and extremely cruel policy of ripping children from their caregivers.
What is Patricia asking for from the Trump administration?
Well, her claim will likely be filed later this week, and she'll be seeking monetary damages, knowing that no amount of money can undo the damage that was inflicted by this policy. But the goal here is to hold the Trump administration accountable for the impact of this policy.
How many other immigrant parents are making similar legal claims? I mean, according to government data, we're talking about a lot of children who were separated from their parents, right?
That's correct. I'm aware of about a dozen other claims that are in the pipeline, but I wouldn't be surprised if there are more to come.
What do you think the most challenging part of this case is? I mean, is there, well, number one, is there legal precedent? And going forward, what kind of challenges do you think you face?
It is a challenging case. And, you know, there isn't really clear legal precedent for this exact claim because there's not clear legal precedent for this policy. We've never had a family separation policy in place before. So from that standpoint, anything we argue will be novel and unprecedented. But if you look at the Federal Tort Claims Act, which was enacted in 1945, it was meant to address negligence and misconduct by the government. And, you know, we feel we have a strong case here that this policy was misconduct, that it flies in the face of American values, it flies in the face of the United States Constitution, it flies in the face of just the common law importance of child-parent bonding and parental rights.
Has the federal government ever been sued for negligence or misconduct before?
They have, and there's actually one case, I believe out of New Jersey, the Zuni Rodriguez case, where the government recently settled a family separation that was based on negligence. There are other times when the government has been sued. Obviously, each case is different, and our strategy here is unique and novel in a lot of ways.
So after you file this claim, it's a threat of a lawsuit going forward. What happens next? How do you expect this to play out?
The way the claim process works is the administration has a chance to settle this before it actually becomes litigation in court. So we file this claim with DHS and HHS, and the next step is a six-month period that the government has to respond, and they'll have an opportunity to settle this before it goes to court. If that does not happen, then we would be filing a lawsuit after the six-month period lapses.
Maggie Krell, who is chief legal counsel at Planned Parenthood, former California Deputy Attorney General, who's representing Patricia, one of several immigrant parents, suing the Trump administration for separating them from their kids last year. Maggie, thank you for taking time out today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. In the last century, the Pacific Ocean has only risen about 9 inches along the California coast. And during that time, from San Diego to San Francisco, homes and businesses have been built right up to the shoreline, taking full advantage of the beautiful beaches and coast. But by the end of this century, climate scientists project that the sea could rise anywhere from 3 to more than 9 feet. Meaning there could be some big changes for a lot of those coastal communities. Now, last week, Seal Beach residents got a chance to see exactly what that kind of surge in sea level could mean for them. And so let's talk about it. On a Monday, it's Gustavo Arellano, who's here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
What was this presentation that took place down in Seal Beach last week?
What the city is trying to do, they're trying to do what all coastal cities in California actually have to do, which is like a local plan that they could then go to the California Coastal Commission and say, hey, this is what we plan to do in our city in terms of planning over the next, say, 25, 30 years. And this is something that the Coastal Commission historically did to guarantee public access. But in this era of climate change and rising sea levels, basically the Coastal Commission wants to know if these cities are going to do stuff that hopefully will be around in the next 50 years.
Now, the Coastal Commission has a lot of sway when it comes to the beaches of Southern California, correct?
Oh, yeah. They're the judge, jury, and executioner. And you have this all the time. Like, anytime you try to do a housing development or even restaurants, you have to go through the Coastal Commission and they say A or nay. And of course, that upsets a lot of the residents of these coastal communities, which almost always, I think maybe besides Imperial Beach and Port Hueneme, tend to be upper class and exclusively white. So in this case, here's the Seal Beach City Council going to the residents and saying, hey, this is the projections that California scientists are giving us, and we're just letting you know so you could we could all try to figure something out together for the next 50 to 100 years.
If you're someone who lives along the coast there in Seal Beach, what were you told about sea level rise? I mean, how much are they looking at?
Well, so there's two scenarios. There's the likely scenario, which is says only about a 6-inch rise, in the next 50 years, and a 1.6 feet rise in the next 100 years. That's a likely scenario. But what the state is projecting and telling Seal Beach this is the projection you should be working off is going to be a 1.6 foot level rise by 2050, and a possibility all the way in 2100 of a 6.6 foot sea level rise. If that were the case, downtown Seal Beach was a really cool little just Main Street, and there's a Pacific Electric Railway Museum there. It would become an island because the water, like water, would just go all around it.
I think we're getting the idea that no matter who it is, they're saying sea level rise will accelerate over the course of the decades, correct?
Oh, yeah. My paper, the Los Angeles Times, we had this really chilling story a couple of weeks ago about sea level rise in California. And it had this funny little game where you were given different scenarios to try to stop the sea, everything from sea berms to trying to build seawalls to just retreating inside into the coast. And it doesn't work. The sea's coming for us, whether we like it or not.
All right. So what is the city then doing to prepare for that? Are they taking any precautions at this point?
Right now, well, for the past couple of years, they've been building every winter a sand berm that blocks off the ocean. What's next going to happen is they're thinking of building a seawall. I mean, really, their options are limited, right? And it's already affecting Seal Beach. There was supposed to be a development of a couple of housing developments, and right now it's on stall because the California Coastal Commission is saying, well, this is going to be directly in the area where we think water levels are first going to be rising. So, you know, what are you guys going to do? And so at this meeting, they were talking about even putting lands on stilts. And this is not just happening in Seal Beach, by the way. It's happening all across Coastal OC. In Capistrano Beach, the water there has just been chipping away to the point where it's destroying now seawalls that were erected back in the 1950s. Balboa Island, you know, very picturesque island in Newport Beach, they're already talking about they're going to raise the island, not through hydraulics. I have no idea how they're going to raise it, but they're just going to start building up the island to match sea level rises.
You're talking about putting buildings on stilts. I mean, are they denying any building permits for new homes?
They're not denying permits just yet, but at least the Seal Beach City Council saying to these developers, like, you're going to have to give us better plans, and because right now your plans are basically not acknowledging the reality of rising oceans.
What are residents in Seal Beach and along the OC coastline? What are they saying to all of this?
Oh, it's typical Orange County response. Out of sight, out of mind. It's not happening in my lifetime, so why should I be retreating? But at the same time, you have to acknowledge the reality, especially longtime residents who remember the ocean 50 years ago. They themselves are saying, yeah, it's like the water's coming closer. Every winter, and also after it rains, you hear, you see broadcasts on the local news of flooding in on the Balboa Peninsula and what's called the King Tide, so minor flooding, and they're more common than they used to be in the past. So these residents, at some point, either they're going to have to get floating houses that can go with the ocean or up in the air, or they're going to have to go inland.
Gustavo Arellano, reporter for the LA Times, and every Monday he's with us here on Greater LA. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Well, we are three months into this new show of ours, Greater LA. We have covered the big stories of the day: homelessness and housing, giga mansions, street sweeps, immigration. We visited an earthquake fault with Lucy. That was a lot of fun, by the way, to see the earthquake fault in Altadena. Rabid soccer supporters. We've taken you everywhere, even Downey, to check out the Columbia Memorial Space Center, where the Apollo mission was designed and constructed. Can you believe that? We'd love to hear from you now, though. What's a great Greater LA story that you think needs to be told? What would you like to hear more about on this radio station and particularly on this show? Reach out to us on our webpage, kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Hit us up on KCRW's Twitter and Facebook pages, hashtag it Greater LA so we can see it. This show is powered by Los Angeles, which means we want to hear from you. You are Greater LA. Tomorrow, when people get together at the beach at night, it can get quite fishy. It's The Business next. Catherine Barnes, Sonia Guys, Phil Richards, Reg Warna, PJ Shahamat, and Christian Bordahl. They're all making this show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great day. Thanks for the ear.